You're listening to OWW Radio,
the official radio show of OnlineWorldOfWrestling.com.
All right, so here we are, living it day by day. You are a superstar, and yes, that's what she used to always say.
Hello and welcome to OWW Radio. This is your host, Alex Goff, and this podcast has actually been nominated for an award. And I'm not sure when the voting for the awards go, but it's still quite the achievement to be nominated for an award in the world of many, many podcasts. And today is the day after UFC 170, and the day of Elimination Chamber, and the day before the WWE Network launches. I'm your host, Alex Goff, and this week I am joined by Garrett Gonzalez of Pie Game Blog. How are you doing this week, Garrett?
What's up, man? Congrats on the nomination for the award. Anytime you get nominated for something on the internet, you know, that shows that you have a pretty decent fan base, so congrats.
The podcast award genre, I mean, just being honest, I guess, it's interesting because there is so much material and space online for people, right? You can kind of carve out your own niche. And I think there is something to, you know, just being nominated for something, but then there's no, that I'm aware of, there's no big, you know, like this is the standard award that you're trying to achieve yet. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. I see how, I work in the internet industry for a startup, and I see how a lot of the awards happen, and in a lot of it is about, you know, how hard your PR team, you know, will push your product and how good of a relationship you have with, you know, some of these the people who do them. But, you know, in this sense, you know, there's 5 million wrestling podcasts out there and, you know, and MMA podcasts. So to have at least a little bit of an audience, I think, is a pretty good deal.
Yeah, so thank you very much for whatever the process went down to have us recognized, at least. I'm not aware of that. But the most important thing is that people are listening and people are enjoying the podcast. We could win 500 awards, but that's the most important thing to me. As long as people are listening, people enjoy it. And today we got some pretty good topics to discuss. But first of all, let's start off with last night, UFC 170. Ronda Rousey defended her title in a first-round TKO versus Sarah McMahon. What were your thoughts on the main event? The fight, controversially, people believe, was stopped early. What were your thoughts on the fight?
I would agree that it was stopped early for sure. You know, one thing that I wonder is, if Herb Dean had stepped in right at the liver shot when Ronda hits Sarah McMahon with the knee against the cage, Sarah goes down immediately, and I think anybody who has been watching MMA for a decent amount of time knew exactly what had happened. Because we've seen it, you know, you don't see a liver shot on every show that drops somebody, but it happens enough to where you go, I've seen that before. And, you know, Boss Rutten joked that, you know, he got a ton of replies on his Twitter handle, so he knew what had happened and had to watch the fight. So it, you know, if you watch MMA a decent amount, you knew what had happened. So what I wonder is, if Herb Dean stepped in immediately after the liver shot, right when Ronda pounced, would the questions about the stoppage be different today? Because what he did instead was he allowed Ronda to come in, and I don't think Ronda was really sold on the punches that she was throwing while Sarah was down. They were sort of short, and you know she didn't really sell out on those punches on the ground. So it made it look really weak. And as Sarah's getting up is when Herb decided to stop it. So you know I think eventually, just based on the style and how Ronda was going into this fight strategically, it didn't seem like it was going to be that hard of a fight for her, or at least as hard of a fight as I thought it was going to be. But still, you know, it was either, you could look at it either being, you know, I don't know, a little bit early, or maybe even a lot early if Sarah actually did get her bearings back. So just a bad night for Herb. He also had another bad stoppage in the Mike Pyle fight, and then that adds on to his bad stoppage in the Uriah Faber fight. So, you know, probably not a good time to be Herb Dean right now.
You know, a few years ago, actually the first time I attended a UFC show, it was a UFC fight night, and they did it at the Miramar Air Base for the Marines there. And I attended that show. I was an active duty Marine at the time. And I spoke to Herb Dean because I remember it wasn't that long ago before that controversially people had said he stopped the third or the second Tito Ortiz Ken Shamrock fight. And he said, you know, people are always going to, you know, hate on whatever job you do. And he kind of acted kind of, you know, like he didn't take it to heart. But I think after last night, we can definitely say that there is the potential that you can see that maybe the judges do take, I mean, the referees do take it to heart. Last UFC, UFC 169, in the main event between Hendon Brow and Uriah Faber, there was some controversy over it. Did he stop that fight early? And, you know, you're kind of living, I guess, in a bubble. Because Herb does other shows, Herb does other events, and so I don't think the last fight that he reffed was the Faber Brow one, but it was definitely the last high-profile one. And so it almost seemed like you go from that one to the Mike Pyle fight, where he let it go on way too long, and then it seems like, you know, he caught bad, whatever, people spoke out negatively about it. And then the very next fight, he stepped in maybe a little bit too early. So it's kind of interesting how it goes from fight to fight to fight like that if you're following it on a trend. But also, something that I think none of us can really speak to is that his view in the cage is kind of a lot different than our views on television, because we get the three replays afterwards. And actually, when I looked at some of the replays, the stoppage looked different to me when I watched it live. When I watched it live, it looked like he stopped a lot quicker than what he did when I watched the replay. When I watched the replay, I clearly saw that Sarah was getting up. But while I watched it live, I saw her drop, and instantly I was wanting a stoppage. So can you say that maybe you were affected by the replay, or can you say live, like, yeah, I saw that it was too late?
Well, I just think that it's one of the hardest things, and to say that he has not, to say that those, both of those decisions were not influenced in any way by his last UFC fight decision, I don't know. I mean, maybe it does. I mean, he's a human being who has probably heard, you know, all of it. I don't know, you know, if he heard anything from the commission about that, but still, it's got to be on his head at some point. And, you know, I jokingly wrote that, you know, poor TJ Waldberger had to pay for Herb's quick stoppage on Uriah, because he let that fight go 30 seconds too long, maybe even longer. And so, you know, maybe those two things are in his mind, and you know, he knows how ferocious Ronda is, and, you know, maybe he thought, like, oh, wow, like, she's down with a liver shot. It would be terrible for Ronda to grab her arm right now and just throw an arm bar on. Like, maybe he's thinking those things. I don't know. But in every replay that I saw, including live, I thought it was too early based on when he stepped in. Now, I you know, I have the GIF on my website, and I was just kind of checking it out again, you know, with fresh eyes. And there's very little time between when Sarah goes down and when she gets back up. So if he was going to step in, he needed just to be a little bit more quick. But still, it's a hard one. And, you know, Sarah was very graceful and classy about it, but it's got to be burning her too, because, you know, the way that she lost this fight, and then, you know, she had in the Olympics, you know, the way that she lost her gold medal match, you know, just sort of kind of not it wasn't the same way, but it was a match in which she was ahead and she kind of lost late. So, you know, she's had lots of frustrations in these big game fights. Including, you know, then losing in the qualifier in 2008 and not even making the Olympics. So, you know, it's got to be burning her. And I thought originally this fight was probably 6 months too early, and that if it happened later in the year, I thought Sarah would be a little bit more prepared. I thought she needed one more fight, which was supposed to happen last year against Sarah Kaufman, and didn't happen because Sarah pulled out for reasons we are still not sure about. And so, you know, she had to take this fight now. I think she's going to be back, though. I think with her pedigree, with her level of athleticism, I mean, you saw her at the Wolverine, and she just ripped to shreds. I think she's going to be back. I think she's going to be a player. But Ronda proved, you know, at least in the minute that we saw, that she sort of figured out and was able to bulldoze through Sarah a little bit and push her right up against the cage. And, you know, Ronda is a beast right now, and I think she showed it again last night.
What's interesting is that I had, you know, I joked with another media member, Heidi Fang, on Twitter that, you know, I watch these press conferences and then I use them to then overanalyze the fights. So I read a lot of things going into this weekend for specifically the top two fights based off a lot of stuff that I saw from the presser. And what's interesting is that I feel like all the things that I believed going into the main event, I didn't have any of it really realized because the fight really didn't go that long. And so I still really don't know if Sarah would be able to impose a wrestling game on Ronda. What's Ronda's, you know, I'd post on Facebook earlier this week that, you know, Henry Huron Gracie had kind of taken the mantle of, hey, we are Ronda's jiu-jitsu trainers. And I was very interested to see what Ronda was going to do flat on her back. After a girl had taken her down, what was she going to do flat on her back? And we didn't get to see that. And what we saw was Ronda utilizing a clinch to be able to push Sarah against the cage. But I don't know if it would have went to minute three, minute four, what we would have seen out of either girl. And I still have somewhat of an interest to see that fight, even though I still have a lot of questions about Sarah.
And like I said, I think we will see it. Like, I think, you know, they flashed the top 10 in the women's bantamweight division last night. And I looked for someone who could be a contender. And outside of Kat Zingano, who's coming back from a knee injury and coming back from the emotional stress of, you know, her husband committing suicide, like, who knows when she's going to be ready? I know Ronda said she thought she deserved it at the press conference, but who, like, how do we know that Kat's going to be ready? I don't think the UFC knows that when she's going to be ready. So you have Kat, and then, you know, Misha's number two, and then Sarah's there, and it's just like after that, you know, you watched, I'm sure you watched the prelim main event between Jessica Eye and Alexis Davis. Did either of those women look like they stood any sort of chance at Ronda?
I was discussing this actually with my wife last night and a friend she brought who wasn't as familiar with MMA. And it's a really hard point to make without sounding sexist, but I'll try to make it here on the air, is that in male MMA, the vacuum real quick was closed up for hard workers, right? There was a time in male MMA where I believed that if you were just a hard worker, you could get into the sport relatively young, like 18, 19, and you could be successful. And I think that vacuum's kind of closed up to where you kind of have to have an elaborate pedigree. You have to be an expert at a discipline. There is not much room for guys who get into the sport, you know, 18, 19, and just work real hard. But in women's MMA, there's a giant vacuum for that. In fact, most of the division is women who aren't necessarily experts in any particular discipline, but are just real, real hard workers and women who go to work, right? But Ronda's the opposite. Ronda has a genetic pedigree. Her mother was an accomplished judoka herself, and she was an expert judoka herself in her own right, an Olympian, and a very, very hard sport for women. There's a lot, the big pool. It's almost like what you're saying. Ronda is not saying she's unbeatable, because no one's unbeatable, but what you're viewing isn't the distance between 3-1 isn't the same in the women's bantamweight division as it is in the male 155 pound division. Does that make sense? Or
yeah, no, I agree with you, because if you go back to the mid 2000s, you had Matt Hughes as one of the dominant champions in the UFC, and he was able to be like that because he was a really good wrestler and he was strong as hell. And the time that, you know, his day was over was when George St. Pierre had finally put it all together mentally as well and beat him. And so, you know, that was sort of a sign of change for what you were just describing. GSP was the, you know, just all around more well-rounded MMA fighter, but he had to get over the idea of being champion and all that. And so, no, I completely agree with you. And now, you know, I just pulled up this list again, and it's like, okay, Kat, I think Kat has a legitimate chance. Do I think it's a great one? I don't think it's a great one, but I think she's the next one in line. Misha, we've seen that happen already. Misha's not gonna beat Ronda. Alexis Davis, we saw her last night. I was impressed in the sense of, you know, wow, she fought hard, but athletically, like, Ronda is at just, you know, a different level, and you cannot beat Ronda Rousey, like you said, just by being a hard worker. You have to have some other tools in the tool chest, as well as be a legitimate athlete. And that's why I thought Sarah was going to be someone down the line, because she has the athletic background, maybe not to match Ronda because she's now 6 years older than Ronda, but still close enough in the prime to where, you know, she's the number two athlete in the women's division. Sarah Kaufman, like, we've seen that fight before. Liz Carmouche, we saw that fight. Amanda Nunes, I mean, you know, maybe in 2 or 3 years, Amanda Nunes, you know, has a chance. You know, and then you go down the line, poor Juliana Pena. But, you know, when your number 14 and 15 fighters in the division is Jessamyn Duke and Jessica Rakosi, who just came off of the Ultimate Fighter, it's a little bit of a narrow division. And I think that's why they're trying to ramp up on these Ultimate Fighters to get more women in there.
Well, I'll even go one step further and discuss Christiana Cyborg, because that was a lot of discussion coming out of last night. I believe that Ronda is so polarizing, so dominant. I think that they want to create a challenger for her because of the exact situation you've described, that the person who people believe, I think, would give her the toughest fight is Kat Zingano. But I don't believe people are fully invested in the Kat winning. And unfortunately, Kat, the suicide thing, I think, is under-discussed because her husband, Dave called them estranged. Did you listen to Observer Radio last night?
I just started listening to it before we started this, so I did not get a chance to finish the whole thing.
Dave Meltzer on Observer Radio called Kat Zingano and her husband estranged. And so when I hear that term, I think that maybe they were having marital problems before. I'm not sure what exactly was going on, but him committing suicide, I think, is an under-discussed story because how it affects her training going forward. Because how can you walk into they trained at his gym. So how can you walk into that gym again after he committed suicide? I think it's going to have lasting effects, and maybe she won't want to go forward. You know, I mean, I think that's an entirely realistic possibility, something we have to wait and see. That's purely speculation, but I can't say I'd be entirely surprised if going forward maybe she wasn't as interested in MMA, considering that was her link, was her husband.
Yeah, I mean, and we're just speculating and sort of guessing, because it is a scary situation for her. I heard the same thing. I think I read in the Observer that they were having some problems before he had committed suicide. And, like, here's another thing. It's like, let's say that Kat decides that, you know, this is going to be the best thing for her and her family, which is to take this fight. And she has, you know, a lot of these things in the background coming off of knee surgery. I mean, that's like, you know, that's like buzzard meat for Ronda, right? Like, is there any way Kat can be completely 100% emotionally and physically ready? I don't see it. Like, what my hope is that they don't push her into this fight. And when I say they, I mean the UFC, who, you know, they want to give you chances to take fights. And if you don't take those fights, Dana White, if he doesn't like you, like Alistair Overeem, he will bury you. But also behind the scenes, you remember when Ronda came into the UFC and he, like, outwardly just was like, yeah, nobody wants to fight her. And Misha's like, hold on, like, what do you mean? And Sarah McMahon was like, well, what do you, like, no, we didn't say no. But the idea was, like, you will give you an opportunity, and if you don't say yes immediately, that tells us that you don't want it or that you don't think you're ready. And I think if they do that with Kat right now, that would be really insensitive. And I think they, you know, I think what they should be doing right now, and they may be doing this, and I don't know, but they should be helping her, you know, with therapy or with money or something to just kind of, you know, take care of her in that way so that she doesn't have to worry about taking this fight and the stress and the, you know, everything involved of being in a title fight with Ronda Rousey, which comes with lots of media. You know, I think that would be the best thing, and if they were being sensitive about this, I think that's what they would do, and hopefully they will. You know, the problem is now, though, that if it's not Kat, then who is it? And you mentioned Cyborg, and by Dana's comments last night, it seems like he's very much wait and see with Cyborg. Like he does not trust her to make the weight. He doesn't want it to be a situation where, you know, they sign for the fight and come, you know, come weigh-in day, she's 7 pounds over, and then they have a mockery of the, you know, the fight there. And so I can sort of see that. I can also sort of see prognosticators who will think that Dana doesn't want Cyborg to come in and fight Ronda because of, you know, Ronda being a big money earner for them. And we saw what happened with Strikeforce when Cyborg won the title from Gina. She could not keep the popularity of the division over with her just being champion. So there may be some of that, but I do think that most of this is because Dana just doesn't trust Cyborg to make weight. You know, the Tito thing probably still has left a sour taste in his mouth, even though Tito says, you know, that he's out of the picture now, which he may be, but I'm sure, you know, he's still probably talking to her and stuff. But yeah, you know, it's a whole big thing, and it's going to be interesting to see how it tells the whole story out, because, you know, Ronda has, you know, some movies and stuff to do. So, you know, she's probably not coming back until, what are they saying, summertime?
I believe they were trying to say August at the earliest, but Dave was under the impression that they may push for July.
And would that be the 4th of July?
Yeah, the 4th of July weekend, yes.
And that is the weekend of the convention, correct?
Correct, yes.
The F4W Wrestling Observer Convention. Like, that would be amazing, you know, just to go live to see Ronda fight. That sounds like a good time period. She's a busy woman, and she's still able to compete at such a high level. I imagine at some point it's got to catch up to her, but she's in the prime of her life physically, and, you know, she's something else, man.
Okay, I'm going to try to get Todd on, because Todd keeps going online and then offline, and then I want to talk about the Cyborg point, two separate points on Cyborg, and first let me try to get Todd on.
Okay.
How's it going, Garrett?
Hey, what's going on, man?
Not much.
Hold okay. On. Through the power of editing, hopefully you didn't hear my dogs barking, and because I had an explosion like right outside my door, Todd, and my dogs freaked out. So through the power of editing, hopefully you wouldn't have heard my dogs explode, but hopefully after Garrett made his points about Cyborg, you will hear the voice of Todd Martin, Wrestling Observer contributor, LA Times contributor, also a frequent guest on Sure Dog Radio and other podcasts, recently did a podcast for AngryMarks.com, and Todd, what we were discussing was obviously the UFC from last night, and I had two points I wanted to make about Cyborg before I allow you to discuss your thoughts last night on the main event. But Cyborg, like I said earlier, I believe that she's presented as a challenger because she's the most attractive, I think, challenger outside of Kat Zingano, which she has inherent problems, which we've discussed. But Cyborg is a world jiu-jitsu champion, but I believe only at the blue or purple belt level. And the person she defeated was Amanda Lucas. So, again, earlier I was discussing pools. And so when you say Cyborg, for example, is a world jiu-jitsu champion, that's not the same thing as even when they say Galval from Bellator, who won the world jiu-jitsu championship, I believe, as a blue or purple belt as well. That's not exactly the same thing because of different level of talent pools. And also, Cyborg, if we look at her competitors at Strikeforce, generally, even up into her last win in Invicta, generally she goes against women who are just a lot smaller than her and maybe shouldn't be competing in the same weight class as her. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see how she does against someone like Ronda. I don't believe that she has a lot of... I don't believe she's going to be as close of a matchup for Ronda as some believe. And secondly, the media aspect of it and Dana's utilization of the bully pulpit during these negotiations. I think sometimes fighters don't it's not so much they don't want the fight. It's that's their opportunity to negotiate something, right? And I think from the outside we think, well, they signed contracts and yada yada. But Dana's also made it public that he gives a lot of bonuses, a lot of extras. And if the fighters believe that's their opportunity to negotiate, i.e. Anderson Silva many, many times, and then Dana goes right to the media and, oh, he doesn't want the fight, da-da-da-da-da-da. I think that what happens is that he gets the fan support behind him to make some of the fights he wants to make, and oftentimes it's at the loss of the fighters because they don't have the same bully pulpit that Dana has. And I don't exactly think it's fair a lot of times what Dana does to the guys. But, Todd, just some quick points about last night, and then if you have anything to add about the Cyborg or Kat Zingano.
Okay, a lot thrown out there. As far as the show last night, I thought it was another sort of underwhelming show, not terribly satisfying, particularly if you sat through all the prelims, which were kind of dull on balance. Main card was better. I thought that, you know, it was disappointing that the fight, the main event was stopped perhaps a little bit early, but certainly, I think a justifiable stoppage given the way that McMahon reacted to the need of the body, even if I would have liked to have seen McMahon get a little bit more of a shot to try to recover, given that it was the main event. Cormier looked very good in dispatching Cummins. I heard talk afterwards essentially saying that the whole thing was a put-on. And, I mean, Cormier is a smart guy. I think he was obviously aware that, you know, they were selling a fight. But I also think he was likely not too pleased with the things that Cummins said. And the fact that he was throwing his hand so actively after a few fights where he's a little bit more conservative because of hand injuries in the past, I thought that suggested that, you know, perhaps he was, you know, looking to make a point with Cummins in that fight. And then, you know, Rory McDonald and Damian Maia, I thought Rory, you know, it was a solid performance from Rory in the sense that, you know, he had to weather some trouble early on and really poured on late and really took over the fight. I'm not sure what to make of Maia's performance. It seemed like he really seemed out of sorts in the second round. I'm not sure whether it was a shot that sort of had prolonged effects on him, whether he was fatigued, whether it was him playing a little bit of possum, but it was sort of a little bit of a strange performance from Damian Maia, although Rory looked good. As far as Cyborg goes, I think that I'm still not entirely certain that we're going to end up seeing her come over to the UFC to fight Ronda Rousey for a number of reasons. One being that she hasn't made that weight cut yet, even if she says that she has. And I think that's going to be a, you know, formidable obstacle for someone that's always had, you know, a lot bigger weight throughout her career. And I'm also not sure how keen the UFC is on signing her. I think that, you know, they recognize Rousey's marketability, and I'm not sure that how much more Chris Cyborg brings to the table than a lot of other opponents, given that she really hasn't been fighting on particularly high platforms. So I don't know how keen UFC is going to be to make that fight. I think it's probably going to be more on Rousey than anyone else as far as whether she's, you know, excited for it. And if she seems excited for it, I think it's going to make the UFC more interested in trying to get that done.
And specifically about Kat Zingano and her knee situation, and then the suicide of her husband. We were just speculating. Do you think that there's a possibility of Kat wanting to come back this summer, or maybe this fall, or maybe I'm going as far as to say I'm not sure if we'll ever see her again, given those two situations. But when do you think the earliest that maybe we could see Kat, and what are your thoughts on it?
I don't think the injury should be too much of an issue because she was saying that she could have taken this fight against McMahon. She wanted this fight. That was before the issue with her, the passing of her husband, which does raise an interesting question. I mean, I think she'll be back. I don't think a lot of people are sort of apt to retire undefeated in the middle of their careers, particularly given the money that's on the table to make that fight. I do think that you raise a solid point that it may throw off the timing of the fight. She may not want to go into a fight camp in the near future. I'm not sure one way or another. Obviously, that speaks to sort of her, you know, her mental state and how she's coping with the whole thing.
Now, the semi-main, do you want, Garrett, do you want to lump in the semi-main and the Rory fight together, or do you want to talk at length about both?
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, I think
the semi-main, it was kind of what we all thought it was going to be. Like, I think there was some good work done by, you know, the Fox Sports stuff and the Countdown, which tried to paint Cummins as someone who, you know, had legitimate credentials. But then, you know, I think most people saw his age, and they saw the thought of, okay, if he was so great, then why had UFC picked him up yet? And Joe Rogan was doing a pretty hard sell job that was a little see-through on the telecast. So I think it sort of happened, you know, just how we all thought it was. You know, I think for most of the hard part with selling this fight is once Rashad left and we were left with such a short time period, the media job that the UFC did with this show I thought was really terrible. So in a sense, they're trying to sell this Rocky story with hardcore fans, and that's not who the Rocky story works with. The Rocky story works with, you know, a little bit more the casual fans who are, you know, now somewhat interested in this long shot story. And I think most everybody saw through it. So, you know, at the end of the day, what happened, you know, should have happened, and what, you know, I think most of us thought was going to happen. But as far as Rory, you know, I was glad to see it. You know, we saw him fight BJ Penn. And I think some of it was that we all thought that BJ was probably a little long in the tooth, which he is, but still, to see him dominate somebody like BJ Penn, you know, and then to see the next few fights where he wasn't as impressive, I thought that was kind of a bad sign of things. But, you know, I thought last night Roy fought excellently, and, you know, it shows that, you know, Damian Maia, once again, you know, he had a deficiency, and last night it was, he just got way too tired. So, good for Rory, and hope that, you know, he can actually, you know, get back what he had at some point when people were talking about him as like the next guy at that division.
About the semi-main, and a larger point I want to make is that we've seen it. I kind of think we've seen something similar in the WWE as far as announcers losing credibility, and at what point have they lost credibility. And Todd, I believe you made a comment last night in that direction, and in my opinion, they kind of lost credibility because, you know, we're both boxing fans, and I think we remember at the time when I believe HBO was in negotiations with the UFC, and one of the things they wanted to do is have independent commentators commentate these shows, and one of the things that would alleviate is situations like last night where. I think Max Kellerman, if he were calling that show, he would say, you know, Cummins has no chance of beating Cormier, but here's what Cummins brings to the table. But instead, what you got was the Rocky story, the Rocky build, where he's got a chance, he's got a possibility. He dominated him in the wrestling room. And I think where it hurts is, and it's interesting because I don't know if that makes a difference between 500,000 buys and a million buys, but where it hurts for me is where every time that we have to make a contender, Joe Rogan has to do the sell of why this guy's a contender. And I don't take Joe Rogan seriously at all any longer. And I don't know how reflective I am of the fan base and how much of the fan base takes Joe Rogan at his word. Todd, first of all, what are your thoughts on the ability of the announcers to sell and credibility?
Yeah, I mean, it's not something I hear a lot of people talking about, but I really think that's one of the biggest issues confronting UFC right now is that they've got all of these shows, and the announcers are in this mode where they've got to hard sell everything rather than sort of hard selling the stuff that they're most excited about and then just handling other fights as they may be. And I think all of the announcers at this point are sort of one-upping each other from the, you know, the guys that they have that's doing the studio work, to the people that are doing the color commentary. It's very much sort of a, you know, almost an arms race to be as hyperbolic as possible. And, you know, the okay fights get described as good, the good fights get described as awesome, you know, the awesome fights get described as the greatest fight ever. And there's just this constant barrage of hyperbole thrown at you. There are a few ways that it can be a negative. You brought up sort of the whether you believe the announcers anymore, and I think that's an issue as far as them being sort of the pitchmen for your product. But I also just think there's sort of an issue of fatigue where if you keep hearing all of this stuff, you know, month in and month out for these fights that aren't at that level, you sort of think, well, I'm not really as into it as these guys are. Is there something wrong with me? Maybe the sport, you know, just isn't connecting with me the way that it should. Whereas if you had sort of a more traditional approach, like you see with the NFL or Major League Baseball or the NBA, where they're not trying to go over the top and building up a random, you know, regular season game between the Cavs and the Wizards. You know, they're going to call the game, and you can tell they like basketball because they're basketball announcers, but it's not this sell job. And UFC has all these shows, but they feel the need to, you know, build up every fight, whether it's a fight pass fight or, you know, a second tier pay per view. And I really think it has a negative effect as far as the credibility of the announcers and the credibility of the product, because of the way that they try to, you know, they try to blow up everything.
Garrett, I remember back to when Chael actually worked for ESPN. I remember he had some candid comments a couple of times on a couple of fighters he would be asked about, but I don't think we've seen that same Chael Sonnen on Fox. Garrett, what are kind of your thoughts on what Todd had to say?
No, I mean, I agree. It's been a big deal to me, you know, for a little while here, and it shows that, you know, when the product is maybe not as hot as it once was, and you still try to sell it as that, I think the credibility takes a little bit of a hit. You know, but actually, I do have a question for Todd, though, because he is part of the MMA media. At what point do you or how responsible do you think the media is for taking some of this and running with it? And I'm talking about the Cummins story. Like, you know, I really enjoy Ariel Helwani. I think he's really good at what he does. But I wasn't bothered. I guess I was just surprised at how hard he was pushing for this Pat Cummins story. And just how great it was and how the UFC did such a great job finding a guy with such a short amount of time and giving him his chance. Do you think, I mean, does that have anything to do with, you know, maybe the problems that he's had with them recently? Or is that just how he is?
Well, I mean, I don't want to speak too much to Ariel in specific because he's sort of doing his sort of own unique cachet. I think in general, there is sort of a cheerleading component to, you know, a number of members of the media that I think does come across from time to time. And I think it does sort of contribute to that general factor. And I think it's sort of the UFC for a while now has put pressure on media outlets to cover the sport in a certain way. And the ones that do tend to have an easier time of it than the ones that don't. And I think that leads to a certain sort of coverage that, you know, does sort of add to the, you know, sort of the environment we're talking about. The other issue is, I think, just in terms of building up a fight, and I didn't hear Ariel's specific comments about the Cummins fight, but when you're writing about, you know, a story, you're going to tend to focus on whatever it is that makes it most interesting. I mean, that's just the nature of sort of, you know, writing articles about the sport. So I don't think there's anything intrinsically bad about commentators highlighting sort of the most interesting aspects of a fight, but that's different than the sort of, you know, like, oh my God, you know, this is coming up. This is such an exciting fight for something where you probably sense that the person doesn't have as keen of an enthusiasm as they're letting on.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point as well, and I think contradiction, I think, that the main, you know, it's kind of hard to lump all the media members together, but I think one of the contradictions that I've seen recently is the every once in a while you hear discussions about creation of a fighters union, but then whenever Dana White makes his anti-union comments, they promote those as well. So it kind of comes to me as a contradiction, because on one stance, you're attacking the labor movement via you're being used as a conduit for Dana to attack the labor movement, but on the other stance, you're saying that the labor movement needs to be brought into MMA, therefore so these guys can get better deals. And I think it's interesting because because someone needs to talk about, you know, another example I'll use is recently between Gilbert Melendez and Alistair Overeem, is that the media should be there, I believe, to say, you know, this is, Because what it is, and Todd, maybe you can correct me, but it's negotiations. Gilbert Melendez is trying to negotiate with the company. Alistair Overeem is trying to negotiate with the company. And he may very well be hurt. But for the media to almost kind of choose sides or try to represent both sides as being equal, I kind of think it's unfair to the story and unfair to the participants. Am I off base?
Well, in terms of Gilbert, I think that there was sort of some of the framing of where he was coming from, I thought was kind of strange, given that he was just, you know, looking for the best contract that he could get. And I think there's sort of a tendency in general for Dana to go after fighters that he perceives as sort of being difficult one way or another. And yeah, I mean the media often does sort of choose, but I mean you get back and forth on that, because there are people that will criticize the way that UFC handles certain things, just like there will be people that criticize some of the fighters and their individual stances. I don't know how much the media really plays a role in that. I think the issue with Dana going after certain fighters is more just Dana specifically, because that's what's going to get out there one way or another. And I think the issue there is more just the wisdom of, you know, belittling and creating bad will with your employees, more so than any issues with the way that the media chooses to frame it.
Alex, can I chime in quickly with a story? I was able to cover a handful of Strikeforce events. You know, they were in San Jose, which is my hometown. I was able to get a credential for a handful of them. It was really interesting to me to go into the post-fight press conference, and as fighters walked in, to hear media members, or, you know, I guess in some senses Strikeforce was like allowing my blog to be a media, to be credentialed. I'm sure they weren't all, you know, sort of the normal kinds of media, but just hearing people give fighters standing ovations, and to hear before prefacing a question by saying, "You look great out there tonight. Fantastic fight. I'm a big fan." And you know, when I saw that, I was like, "Okay, this is a little bit different." And you know, we're not even talking UFC; we're talking Strikeforce. And it seemed to me, and again, you know, Todd's been there, and so he would know best. But it seemed to me like the folks who were covering these things, and I don't know how many of them still exist, obviously if they were blogs and such, but they definitely wanted to keep coming again, and they were big fans, wanted to keep coming. So I think, you know, I wondered at the time if that had something to do with all of the cheering, and because it was very unprofessional, but it's not like Scott Coker himself looked at it as anything bad.
Well, I mean, I think that it sort of depends on sort of the event. I think the larger the events get, I mean, the more people you credential, the more sort of people on sort of the fringes. I think there's sort of two distinctions. One is sort of the media members that are more full-fledged media that just sort of put out a point of view that's sort of slanted towards the promotion. And the other is just the issue of people that aren't really professional in the first place, being let in. And I think the latter is sort of the issue that would sometimes come up with, you know, some of the Strikeforce events when they'd let in very large numbers of people, and you'd sort of get that contingent. I remember the Affliction shows being like that as well, where Affliction would just, you know, credential pretty much everyone. So I think that becomes an issue at times. But, I mean, to be honest, I never viewed that as a big deal. I think if, you know, if an individual person is acting, you know, like a fan rather than a media member, you know, I don't think it really does that much harm to anyone, and I don't think it really reflects much on anything other than just, you know, that individual person in the outlet they're working for.
So we as we pivot to talk about WWE's Elimination Chamber tonight and the WWE Network, we turned into Online World of Wrestling's reliable sources there, the CNN show that critiques the media. But the media is certainly very interesting, I think, in MMA, because the media obviously has a very, very big responsibility. And then sometimes, as a collective, sometimes I think that they have interesting choices they make. But so that's why I discuss them every once in a while on the show. So tonight, the Elimination Chamber, and tomorrow, the Network. The Elimination Chamber, I think it's an interesting card. The Shield versus the Wyatts is an interesting matchup. What they're going to do specifically in the Elimination Chamber and as it builds toward WrestleMania is going to be very interesting and newsworthy as well. My excitement, I must admit, is kind of tempered because the big news is the network is launching tomorrow evening. So, Garrett, what are kind of your thoughts on the pay-per-view tonight? And how much is your excitement, I guess, kind of tempered by the network coming out tomorrow?
Well, I think they did a pretty strong job with the last two Raws as far as building up interest in the show. The Shield Wyatt stuff has been really well done, and I think they've kind of have all of the fans just at on the edge of their seats waiting to see these two teams finally tangle. So I think they did a really good job there. The Chamber, the booking of the Chamber is going to be interesting because they have to figure out a way to keep Daniel Bryan over. I think he has gotten a little, maybe the Yes chants have gotten a little less loud in recent weeks, so I would like to see them heat him back up again because I think, especially for the hardcore fan base, they're so desperately want to see him look good and do something. I'm just constantly talking to people on Twitter about, there's everyone screwing Daniel Bryan. But, I'm really interested. I think, Batista's been really underplayed, but it's going to be his first match in years, first singles match. The Usos, if you're a fan of the Usos, which I am, hopefully it's a big night for them. They've been really good recently, too. I think they're in an interesting spot, though, because it is pre-WrestleMania, it is pre-network, so, there may be a lot of people kind of sleeping on this show, but I do expect it to be pretty entertaining. And I'll admit, because of the fact that that we know a lot of what's supposed to happen, but I am interested to see how they do what they usually do with Orton and Cena and Bryan and the Shield and those guys. Because I think we sort of know where the end game is, but I still am interested to see, creatively how they get there. And so that's a plus. And then, with the network, I tweeted jokingly that, I wish I was taking Tuesday off so I could really play with the thing and see what's out there. But, I think it's going to be positive, as far as their business, and what kind of hits they're taking and what numbers they'll bring in, That's harder for me to think about because I don't really know that area all that well. But I know Todd's buddy Ben has been covering it pretty well, and I've loved reading a lot of his business stuff. So I think it's just intrigue. There's intrigue and there's hype around the network, and there's hype around WrestleMania. So I think all that is good, and I'm just I just want to enjoy to see where they're going to go.
What's interesting is that they can't create this kind of excitement all year, because even though I say my excitement's tempered, it's only because the network is coming out. The network's going to revolutionize the way that the wrestling product gets delivered as far as old content and new content. But this show on its face is an interesting show, in my opinion. I'm very interested to see the results coming out. And Todd, kind of what are your thoughts, and why can't they do this all year?
I like the card. I think it's a good card. And I think they've done a good job of building it up, more so than, any show really in a while, I think, particularly the Wyatts and the Shield. I think they've done a good job building it up. As far as the build for the WrestleMania period versus other periods, I mean, there are a number of factors at play. One is that they've got a better talent roster because they bring back guys. So you've got, sort of more talent, which allows you to, and better talent, which allows you to build things up a little bit better. Another is just that they've become so reliant on the show more so than individual performers that just knowing that it's the period of the year where you've got the big show coming up, I think adds additional intrigue that wouldn't be there otherwise. Like the Batista and Randy Orton program being, sort of a prime example, and that not that it's like the hottest issue ever, not that it's the hottest issue ever as is, but certainly it's one of those things where if it were coming at another time of year, I think there would be, it would just feel like another match. Whereas the fact that it's coming at WrestleMania, I think, adds a little bit more gravity. So I think the show being just the fact that they are the big shows, I think, makes the things feel more important. And then the third factor that I think sort of plays into it is they just tend to pay a little bit more attention around WrestleMania season. They know they've got the big show coming up, and thus there's an increased an increased impetus to get it right. Whereas other times of the year, I think they just sort of, there isn't the same, the same care put into building up the programs because you know it isn't such an important show.
I guess I'm going to say something kind of controversial going forward is that WWE Network is going to revolutionize, like I said, wrestling content delivery. But as far as, I guess, creating stars, creating good matchups, WWE certainly has shown issues with a lot of its big stuff. Like I said, they're able to create interest in a few of the programs going toward WrestleMania, but throughout the years they kind of struggle. My concern is that a lot of the older voices, I guess, in the wrestling community, guys who have had great experience and great success running and developing professional wrestling products, as WWE continues to change and makes a bigger change, I kind of think that maybe they're going to be kind of left in the dust, maybe. Gary, am I wrong about that? As wrestling changes, maybe some of the older voices maybe won't keep up with it, and they're going to kind of seem, I don't know, kind of outdated?
I'm still trying to figure out, you're not talking about the older fans, you're talking about the older people in the business?
Well, fans maybe too, right? Because the way that the professional wrestling product is going to be delivered and the way fans are going to enjoy it, I think, are going to be different than in any other era because of the network. And as long as people are invested in that network, I think, and as long as they're able to keep decent house show numbers, but with the fact they're moving away from pay-per-view, and Ben Miller and I had a discussion on this when I had him on, is that the selling point for an event like a pay-per-view is going to be a lot different than when you're selling content like they are with the network. And as long as they can keep people invested in the content that the network provides, they're going to keep their viewership up, much in the way of Netflix, right? Netflix doesn't offer Friday night, we have this big event. They offer every month you'll have great content. And I think it's going to kind of be interesting going forward, conversations in wrestling. I think that some people may look kind of outdated because they're not going to be pushing the event so much anymore as they're going to be pushing the network. Therefore, I think that the professional wrestling business that WWE has is going to change. Is that kind of...
Okay. I think I see where you're going with this a little bit more. It has to, though, because if they are 100%, sold on this idea and that's where they're going, they're going to push this thing like crazy for the next year and then if it succeeds, into the future, a lot of the old school mentalities and the way that they used to do business will have to change. And I think there's going to be a lot of learnings created. Like if you're WWE, I hope that they, and I'm sure they have, done their homework as far as, what Netflix and Hulu and where they've succeeded and where they haven't and all those things. But what Netflix really does is they're able to create, like, I think their marketing is awesome in that they're able to create a ton of hype around shows that they've done that are good. But you notice that they've done more shows that, that haven't been as good as, House of Cards or Orange is the New Black. And those kind of go by the wayside, but for when House of Cards came out for season 2, like, there was so much hype around that show just by them putting it out all on the same day and just saying, okay, it's on a Friday, watch as many of these things as you can over the weekend. And then everybody talks about it. And then so people hear everyone talking about it and they go, oh, now I got to watch season 1 so that I can watch season 2. Like, I think that is really good. And what I wonder with WWE is, we have the push for the network for Monday night, and I think they've done an exceptional job creating awareness there. But then what happens after Mania? Like, what happens in the summer? Are they going to create some hype around now we have the entire 1997 Raw season on the network. You know, or what are they going to be able to do? Is it going to be new shows? I don't really think that you know, just based on how they do movies and shows and such, like, I don't know if they're going to be able to create really super interesting content which people can get invested in, you know, via new shows. But what is it going to be? What's going to be that hook for the non-Mania season when, you know, when they go, okay, here's what, you know, is it going to be, it's not going to be Mid-South, you know, UWF, like, for a hardcore fan base, yes, like, and once they put those tapes on, they'll be like, you know, we're in, you know, we're calling in sick for work the next day. But for the, you know, for the normal WWE fan, like, I know for sure, you know, because of the way that we're going to be able to do this, you know, my kid has a Roku box in his room, I have an Apple TV, you know, we have iPads. So I'm sure that my kids, who are, you know, they're casual wrestling fans, they enjoy it. You know, we'll go watch pay-per-views and, you know, we'll have parties around that. But they don't watch Raw every week. They're going to be more intrigued, I think, on the idea that finding a lot of the content that they want will be easier. But then again, I'm still thinking, okay, what's going to hook them? Like, what are they going to go, oh, like, this is cool. Like, I want to watch this old, you know, WWF pay-per-view from 1998. Like, I still don't know how that is going to happen. So lots of interesting things, and just the idea that, you know, the content is going to be available for me is great, but I'm not like everybody. You know, I really brought, you know, I was really interested and hopeful that they would go this model, but that's because I'm selfish, and I know that I can access this stuff, you know, a lot easier than other people because of the, you know, my technology, you know, where I am in technology. So that I'm being selfish, and I know it's not going to be as easy with others. Like, I know folks who are like, oh, if they're not on pay-per-view, like, how am I going to watch this stuff? I'm not technologically sound. You know, I don't even like watching stuff on my computer. So there is definitely that demographic out there too.
What are kind of your thoughts about the network?
Okay. A lot of stuff there. I guess sort of a couple thoughts based on what you guys were talking about. One is that I don't know if we should assume that this is going to be the model going forward. I mean, it's certainly what they're investing in right now, but as far as, like, the business changing, that's predicated on this thing taking off in its current form. And I think it's less likely than you know, 50% that it is going to take off in its current form. So whatever we get going forward, you know, if it's a variation on this to some degree, you know, it may change sort of the calculus of how we view it and the way they're putting together the product. As far as your original question about how the business may essentially change with the model being based more around subscribers than around, you know, sort of traditional, well, you didn't say this, but I think some people are thinking on these lines, sort of building up matches. I think that any form of entertainment is better when you're telling long-term stories that make you want to see specific things down the line. So, I mean, I hear sometimes people talking about Impact or Raw, and it's like, well, you know, they're not so concerned with building up a pay-per-view or building up a house show because, you know, they're getting the money from the television, and that's sort of their primary driver. And I'm like, there's no reason you can't do both things, right? Like, both build an entertaining television product and get people to pay money for your product in addition on the side. But I think, moreover, that it becomes easier to build up a television show and get ratings for a television show if you are making people excited to see something. If they're watching the show because they know that there's this culmination coming down the line to this big match that's going to happen, I think that's a good hook. Just like in any, you know, successful television show, there are going to be storylines that are building up that you're waiting to see the conclusion for. And it may not come for the entirety of the season, or, you know, may even lead to a cliffhanger to another season, but you're being kept in the loop of what's happening and captivated by it, by the way they build it up. And I think that sort of thing is beneficial regardless of whether you're distributing the product through a network or distributing it through television or distributing it through pay-per-view.
To play devil's advocate, because I don't know if I fully believe what I'm going to say, but I'm going to make this argument. So, if you're World Wrestling Entertainment, what you were looking at before 2000, before, I guess, the recent eras, you were looking at a business that had giant ebbs and flows. And it was all dependent on if you were able to capture a certain superstar and he was able to become a pop culture thing, right? So you had the Hulk Hogan era, and then you had, you know, the beginning, I guess, the John Cena era, the Stone Cold Steve Austin era. And when you didn't have one of those guys or you were in the middle of cultivating one of those guys, you had lulls in your business, right, that lasted a couple of years. And so if you're World Wrestling Entertainment, do you believe that maybe the calculus is that instead of having the big highs and the big lows, we can keep it steady? Therefore, when we go into negotiations for the television contracts, which are a big driver of business now, that we are able to negotiate a better rate because we won't be caught in a down period. Do you believe that maybe that's part of the calculus?
I think that there's definitely an interest in being able to get, well, to answer the question just as far as what I think their mentality is, no, I don't think that's their mentality. I think that's been an offshoot of the way they've booked, which over time they've lost focus with long-term booking. They've had trouble creating new stars, and as a result they have over time become more, you know, sort of a more of a product that's less susceptible to ebbs and flows. But I don't think that was a conscientious strategy, to answer your basic question there. As far as whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I mean, you can see both sides of it. I mean, I'd like to think, though, that you could have a product that has a consistently high, you've got a bunch of different revenue streams that aren't going to go up or down because you've got, you know, merchandise and they've capitalized on very well. They've got their house show business, which is sort of like the traveling circus, which is very consistent. They've got the television rights fees. We've got all these revenue streams that are pretty consistent. I feel like you can do that and also have the ability to build up stars at a particular point in time that gets your product hotter than it was. And I think it's hard to really get a business boom if you are sort of that continual flat line. So I think there is something to be said for having that consistency, having that protection against sort of a more volatile business. But I think that a lot of those protections have just been offered up as a natural progression of the way that the TV landscape has changed and the way that the WWE has capitalized on just a really very solid, you know, business plan. And I don't think that those things are necessarily linked to the creative issues that have made it harder to create big new stars.
Garrett?
I like a lot what Todd said, and I think the ability to take the average or where business is now and sort of what you said and, you know, making it a little bit more predictable and you know, not being so volatile because of pay-per-view and because of trying to find attractions. You know, Vince McMahon for SummerSlam, you know, basically said John Cena and Daniel Bryan wasn't the right attraction. And I don't know, I mean, I guess the numbers bear that out, but there was also the way that match was built up that was probably a big reason. But, you know, what should happen and what they should be trying to do, and I hope this is what they're trying to do, is in all of this, in all of trying to make, you know, make the business a little bit more predictable for them, they should also be trying to create the... They're at a certain average as far as, you know, interest with ratings and with buys and with network stuff. Like, if you do get something hot, then that should give you the new average, and that new average should be higher than where you were. And so I don't think there is a reason to stop, you know, trying to get guys hot and just basically give out the same product over and over and over again. Like, I think when they are able to do things right, like let's say that Roman Reigns is a hit. Let's say that Roman Reigns, you know, if he is booked the way that he could be booked, and, you know, come SummerSlam, he's hot as hell and they give him the strap, you know, maybe he does bring more awareness around it, and maybe that's then the new average from where they go from there. So I think that if they're doing things right and they're making guys and with the, you know, the NXT stuff, you know, there's going to be more eyeballs on those guys with the network, you know, that's how they should look at it. It shouldn't be, you know, okay, we're just going to keep sort of this predictable state. Like, let's take that predictable state and let's raise it and now we've created new expectation and that's where we have to stay. And then the next star, then you try to go, higher than that. So that's what I think, but that's also what they've not been doing well, these last several years, because John Cena has been the constant and really nothing else, and I think it shows in their metrics.
Well, guys, we're going to have the opportunity to talk about the network for hopefully years down the line, because it's going to be interesting to follow this thing and see where it goes. Todd, if people are interested in hearing more of your thoughts and opinions, where can they go?
Oh, yeah, you plugged at the beginning, WrestlingObserver.com, Shirtout.com, a variety of other outlets, and I'm on Twitter at Tom Martin MMA.
And Garrett?
The website is fightgameblog.com, and you can use the same fightgameblog for our Twitter handle.
All right, and over at fightgameblog and over at Wrestling Observer, some of the main contributors are, I guess I'm not exactly a contributor of fightgameblog, but making picks for the UFC shows, and at both websites, for all three of us here, you can see...
That sounds like a contribution.
And Alex, I'm going to have you on a podcast, but also... You are a friend of Fight Game Blog.
And I guess I do. I do write about the upcoming fight, so I guess I'm not giving myself enough credit. But we're making picks for the UFCs throughout the year, and you can keep up with our totals at the Wrestling Observer and at Fight Game Blog to see how we do. And this show has a Twitter as well at OWWCOM. And this show will also be posted directly to iTunes and our website, OnlineWorldOfWrestling.com. And thank you very much for listening. All right, well that's okay.